Chapter 85. Vienna, February 3, 98. Dear Joe, there's that letter that I began so long ago. You see how it is. Can't get time to finish anything. I pile up lots of work, nevertheless. There may be idle people in the world, but I'm not one of them. I say private up there because I've got an adventure to tell, and you mustn't let a breath of it get out. First I thought I would lay it up along with 1,000 others that I've laid up for the same purpose to talk to you about, but those others have vanished out of my memory, and that must not happen with this. The other night I lectured for a Vienna charity, and at the end of it Livy and I were introduced to a princess who is aunt to the heir apparent of the imperial throne, a beautiful lady, with a beautiful spirit, and very cordial in her praises of my books, and thanks to me for writing them, and glad to meet me face to face and shake me by the hand, just the kind of princess that adorns a fairy tale, and makes it the prettiest tale there is. Very well, we long ago found that, when you are noticed by supremacies, the correct etiquette is to go, within a couple of days, and pay your respects in the quite simple form of writing your name in the visitor's book kept in the office of the establishment. That is the end of it, and everything is squared up and ship-shape. So at noon today Livy and I drove to the Archducal Palace, and got by the sentries all right, and asked the grandly uniformed porter for the book, and said we wished to write our names in it. And he called a servant in livery, and was sending us upstairs, and said Her Royal Highness was out, but would soon be in. Of course Livy said oh no, we only want the book, but he was firm, and said, You are Americans? Yes. Then you are expected. Please go upstairs. But indeed we are not expected. Please let us have the book and Her Royal Highness will be back in a very little while. She commanded me to tell you so and you must wait. Well, the soldiers were there close by. There was no use trying to resist, so we followed the servant up. But when he tried to beguile us into a drawing room, Livy drew the line. She wouldn't go in. And she wouldn't stay up there either. She said the princess might come in at any moment and catch us, and it would be too infernally ridiculous for anything. So we went downstairs again, to my unspeakable regret. For it was too darling a comedy to spoil. I was hoping and praying the princess would come, and catch us up there, and that those other Americans who were expected would arrive, and be taken for impostors by the portier, and shot by the sentinels, and then it would all go into the papers, and be cabled all over the world, and make an immense stir, and be perfectly lovely. And by that time the princess would discover that we were not the right ones, and the minister of war would be ordered out, and the garrison, and they would come for us, and there would be another prodigious time, and that would get cabled to, and, well, Joe, I was in a state of perfect bliss. But happily, oh, so happily, that big portier wouldn't let us out. He was sorry, but he must obey orders. We must go back upstairs and wait. Poor Livy, I couldn't help but enjoy her distress. She said we were in a fix, and how were we going to explain if the princess should arrive before the rightful Americans came? We went upstairs again, laid off our wraps, and were conducted through one drawing room and into another, and left alone there and the door closed upon us. Livy was in a state of mind. She said it was too theatrically ridiculous, and that I would never be able to keep my mouth shut, that I would be sure to let it out, and it would get into the papers, and she tried to make me promise. Promise what? I said, oh, be quiet about this. Indeed I won't. It's the best thing that ever happened. I'll tell it, and add to it, and I wish Joe and Howells were here to make it perfect. I can't make all the rightful blunders myself. It takes all three of us to do justice to an opportunity like this. I would just like to see Howells get down to his work and explain, and lie, and work his futile and inventionless subterfuges, when that princess comes raging in here and wanting to know. But Livy could not hear fun. It was not a time to be trying to be funny. We were in a most miserable and shameful situation, and if Just then the door spread wide, and our princess and four more, and three little princes flowed in. Our princess, and her sister the Archduchess Marie-Therese, mother to the imperial heir, and to the young girl archduchesses present, and to the three little princes, and we shook hands all around and sat down, and had a most sociable good time for half an hour, and by it turned out that we were the right ones, and had been sent for by a messenger who started too late to catch us at the hotel. We were invited for 2 o'clock, but we beat that arrangement by an hour and a half. Wasn't it a rattling good comedy situation? Seems a kind of pity we were the right ones. It would have been such nuts to see the right ones come and get fired out, and we chatting along comfortably, and nobody suspecting us for imposters. We send lots and lots of love. Mark. The reader who has followed these pages has seen how prone Mark Twain was to fall a victim to the lure of a patent, right how he wasted several small fortunes on profitless contrivances, and one large one on that insatiable demon of intricacy and despair, the page-typed setter. It seems incredible that, after that experience and its attending disaster, he should have been tempted again. But scarcely was the ink dry on the receipts from his creditors, when he was once more borne into the clouds on the prospect of millions, perhaps even billions, to be made from a marvelous carpet pattern machine, the invention of Szczepanik, an Austrian genius. That Clemens appreciated his own tendencies is shown by the parenthetic line with which he opens his letter on the subject to Mr. Rogers. Certainly no man was ever a more perfect prototype of Colonel Sellers than the creator of that lovely irrepressible visionary. To Mr. Rogers, in New York. March 24, 98. Dear Mr. Rogers, I feel like Colonel Sellers. Mr. Kleinberg, agent for Szczepanik, came according to appointment, at 8:30 last night, and brought his English-speaking secretary. I asked questions about the auxiliary invention, which I call O2, and got as good an idea of it as I could. It is a machine. It automatically punches the holes in the jackword cards, and does it with mathematical accuracy. It will do for $1 what now costs $3. So it has value, but number 2 is the great thing, the designing invention. It saves $9 out of $10, and the jackword looms must have it. Then I arrived at my new project, and said to him in substance, this. You are on the point of selling the number 2 patents to Belgium, Italy, etc. I suggest that you stop those negotiations and put those people off 2 or 3 months. They are anxious now, they will not be less anxious then, just the reverse. People always want a thing that is denied them. So far as I know, no great world patent has ever yet been placed in the grip of a single corporation. This is a good time to begin. We have to do a good deal of guesswork here, because we cannot get hold of just the statistics we want. Still, we have some good statistics, and I will use those for a test. You say that of the 1,500 Austrian textile factories, 800 use the jackword. Then we will guess that of the 4,000 American factories, 2,000 use the jackword, and must have our number 2. You say that a middle-sized Austrian factory employs from 20 to 30 designers, and pays them from 800 to 3,000 odd florins a year, a florin is 2 francs, let us call the average wage 1,500 florins, $600. Let us apply these figures, the low wages to the 2,000 American factories with this difference, to guard against over-guessing. That instead of allowing for 20 to 30 designers to a middle-sized factory, we allow only an average of 10 to each of the 2,000 factories, a total of 20,000 designers. Wages at $600, a total of $12,000,000,000. Let us consider that number 2 will reduce this expense to $2,000,000,000,000 a year. The saving is $5, 000, 000 for each of the $200 million of capital employed in the Jacquard business over there. Let us consider that in the countries covered by this patent, an aggregate of $1, 500 million of capital is employed in factories requiring number 2. The saving, as above, is $75, 000, 000 a year. The company holding in its grip all these patents would collar $50, 000, 000 of that, as its share. Possibly more. Competition would be at an end in the Jacquard business, on this planet. Price cutting would end. Fluctuations in values would cease. The business would be the safest and surest in the world. Commercial panics could not seriously affect it. Its stock would be as choice an investment as government bonds. When the patents died, the company would be so powerful that it could still keep the whole business in its hands. Would you like to grant me the privilege of placing the whole Jacquard business of the world in the grip of a single company? And don't you think that the business would grow like a weed? Ach, America, it is the country of the big. Let me get my breath, then we will talk. So then we talked till pretty late. Would Germany and England join the combination? I said the company would know how to persuade them. Then I asked for a supplementary option, to cover the world, and we parted. I am taking all precautions, to keep my name out of print in connection with this matter. And we will now keep the invention itself out of print as well as we can. Descriptions of it have been granted to the Dry Goods Economist, New York, and to a syndicate of American papers. I have asked Mr. Kleinberg to suppress these, and he feels pretty sure he can do it. With love, S. 50. See, if this splendid enthusiasm had not cooled by the time a reply came from Mr. Rogers, it must have received a sudden chill from the letter which he enclosed, the brief and concise report from a carpet machine expert, who said, I do not feel that it would be of any value to us in our mills, and the number of Jacquard looms in America is so limited, that I am of the opinion that there is no field for a company to develop the invention here. A cursory examination of the pamphlet leads me to place no very high value upon the invention, from a practical standpoint. With the receipt of this letter, carpet pattern projects would seem to have suddenly ceased to be a factor in Mark Twain's calculations. Such a letter in the early days of the type machine would have saved him a great sum in money and years of disappointment. But perhaps he would not have heeded it then. The year 1898 brought the Spanish-American War. Clemens was constitutionally against all wars, but writing to Twitchell, whose son had enlisted, we gather that this one was an exception. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford. Colton Lutjeben, near Vienna, June 17, 98. Dear Joe, you are living your war days over again in Dave, and it must be a strong pleasure, mixed with a sauce of apprehension enough, to make it just schmeck, as the Germans say. Dave will come out with 2 or 3 stars on his shoulder straps, if the war holds, and then we shall all be glad it happened. We started with Bull Run, before. Dewey and Hobson have introduced an improvement on the game this time. I have never enjoyed a war even in written history as I am enjoying this one. For this is the worthiest one that was ever fought, so far as my knowledge goes. It is a worthy thing to fight for one's freedom. It is another sight finer to fight for another man's. And I think this is the first time it has been done. Oh, never mind Charlie Warner, he would interrupt the raising of Lazarus. He would say, the will has been probated, the property distributed, it will be a world of trouble, to settle the rows better leave well enough alone. Don't ever disturb anything, where it's going to break the soft smooth flow of things and wobble our tranquility. Company. S.H. It happens every day and we came out here to be quiet. Love to you all. Mark. They were spending the summer at Kaltenleutgeben, a pleasant village near Vienna, but apparently not entirely quiet. Many friends came out from Vienna, including a number of visiting Americans. Clemens, however, appears to have had considerable time for writing, as we gather from the next two owls. To W.D. Owls, in America. Kaltenleutgeben, Berlin, August 16, 98. Dear Owls, your letter came yesterday. It then occurred to me that I might have known, per mental telegraph, that it was due. For a couple of weeks ago, when the weekly came containing that handsome reference to me, I was powerfully moved to write you, and my letter went on writing itself, while I was at work at my other literature during the day. But next day my other literature was still urgent and so on, so my letter didn't get put into ink at all. But I see now that you were writing about that time, therefore a part of my stir could have come across the Atlantic per mental telegraph. In 1876 or 75 I wrote 40,000 words of a story called Iman Wheeler, wherein the nub was the preventing of an execution through testimony furnished by mental telegraph from the other side of the globe. I had a lot of people scattered about the globe who carried in their pockets something like the old mesmerizer button, made of different metals, and when they wanted to call up each other and have a talk, they pressed the button or did something, I don't remember what, and communication was at once opened. I didn't finish the story, though I re-dash began it in several new ways, and spent altogether 70,000 words on it, then gave it up, and threw it aside. This much as preliminary to this remark. Someday people will be able to call each other up from any part of the world and talk by mental telegraph, and not merely by impression. The impression will be articulated in two words. It could be a terrible thing, but it won't be, because in the upper civilizations everything like sentimentality, I was going to say sentiment, will presently get materialized out of people along with the already fading spiritualities. And so when a man is called who doesn't wish to talk, he will be like those visitors you mentioned, not chosen, and will be frankly damned and shut off. Speaking of the ill luck of starting a piece of literary work wrong and again, always aware that there is a way, if you could only think it out, which would make the thing slide effortless from the pen the one right way, the sole form for you, the other forms being for men whose line those forms are, or who are capabler than yourself. I've had no end of experience in that, and maybe I am the only one, let us hope so. Last summer I started 16 things wrong, 3 books and 13 mag. Articles and could only make 2 little wee things, 1500 words altogether, succeed. Only that out of piles and stacks of diligently wrought MS. Comma the labor of 6 weeks unremitting effort. I could make all of those things go if I would take the trouble to re-begin each one half a dozen times on a new plan. But none of them was important enough except one. The story I, in the wrong form, mapped out in Paris 3 or 4 years. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.